on DSTV channel 885
and across the city
on 567 AM.
Good morning, Crystal Audison standing in for Clarence Ford this morning on Views and News. It's now time for our regular Friday conversation with the Naked Scientist, lecturer at University of Cambridge, Dr. Chris Smith, also known as the Naked Scientist, joins us on air once more to answer a variety of science-related questions. Good morning, Chris, and how are you this morning?
Good morning, and I'm all the better for hearing you. How are you?
Fantastic. The sun is out, Chris. We've had about 5 days of rain, so we're all quite happy to just take a bit of a reprieve from the rain.
And a reprieve from election fever, which we're still building up to. Yeah. It's everywhere. Oh. And I was watching, actually, very, very interesting, the dynamic in South Africa at the moment, and it made for very compelling television coverage here. And actually, paradoxically, I was watching your election details to get away from my own election details. It's quite funny, isn't it? It's like someone else's election is a lot less painful than our own. But yes, the sun is shining here as well, so it's a nice way to start the day.
So, Chris, lots of questions. I'll start off with Colleen from Deep River. She says, I was told that skin tags are an indication of diabetes. My family all have skin tags and we all have diabetes. Can you please explain the connection between skin tags and diabetes and why it's an indicator?
Well, it's a brilliant question and it's completely got me. I don't know. I've never been asked that, and I didn't know there was an association between skin tags and diabetes. Thinking back, I do know some people who have a family history and do have skin tags, but then is that confirmation bias on my part? Because you're now asking me to think and make that association. Do I know lots of people with skin tags who don't have diabetes? I don't know. I don't have to think about it. There may be an association. I'm not aware of it. I'll take it away as homework and apologize. I can't tell you this week. I will find out for next time.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Okay, next question. Why does cattle not flee during fires and stand still and let flames engulf them? What's the reason for this?
Well, some animals, a lot of animals, are frightened of fire. And that's actually why our ancestors realized quite early on, harness fire and you garner protection for yourself and those around you. And that's why fire, as well as providing warmth and a way to cook things, was a very valuable asset to our early ancestors, because they could defend themselves with it as well. Because animals were often thrown into a state of confusion by the fire. Sometimes they do run off, sometimes they run in circles, sometimes they do stand stock still. I think it's probably that they get totally confused, bamboozled, and don't know which way to go, and so they end up staying where they are. Sometimes they get overcome by fumes, and in the same way that bees, when you see people who are beekeepers, they blow smoke into their hives. This calms the bees down, and the bees actually interpret the smoke as a threat to their home, so they eat all their honey, and then they go to sleep and stop flying around. And that's why bees become static. But I don't know about other animals, if there's any specific reason other than they're just confused by the situation, frightened, and also they may be overcome by the fumes.
Good morning, Chris and Chris, Crystal. Question, I have a craving for food about half an hour or so after eating an apple. Is there anything in apples that stimulate appetite, or is it just a mind thing? Thanks, Gulls.
Probably a bit of both, actually, because when we eat an apple, we don't get huge numbers of calories from it. There is sugar in there and an acid, so you must make sure you clean your teeth after apples. But the sugar is not in huge abundance, and it will stimulate gastric juices to flow. So you've eaten something, but then you feel hungry because you haven't actually got very many calories out of it, and it doesn't fill you up very much. So it might be that it's partly that, and partly that if you've learned that every time you eat an apple, you feel hungry and then you give yourself a treat, you've programmed your system that apples are a precursor to getting a tasty treat later. And so it then makes you hungry in anticipation of the tasty treat you know you're going to reward yourself with, because you've made yourself feel hungry because you ate an apple.
I like apples, Chris, so thank you for that, because I will be mindful of the next time. A question from Solly. Why are certain cats natural rodent killers and others just couldn't be bothered?
Yeah, we've got one of each. And interestingly, they are sisters. And one of them's absolutely hopeless and it can't be bothered to get out of bed half the time. And it's always been like that. It's not just an age thing. They are a bit older now, but it's always been like that. Always rubbish at hunting. And its much scrawnier sister, which I jokingly said, because she was the runt of the litter and is a really tiny cat. And I always said it's because it's perpetually hungry that it's a good hunter, because it's motivated to go and catch even more to eat because it's so hungry all the time. So it might be that we feed some cats extremely well, and as a result of feeding them very well, they have absolutely no motivation to supplement their diet, so they don't, because they're lazy at heart. And I mean, at the end of the day, why have cats got legs? It really to find the next place to go to sleep for a while, isn't it? That's what they do. They just go to sleep in one place and then move to another place and sleep there. And so it probably is partly motivation by food. And if an animal is hungry, it's going to be strongly motivated to sate that hunger, either by going and stealing another cat's lunch, which cats are notorious for. They break into other people's houses and steal their pet cat's lunch. And this was a problem during COVID. We were actually finding that people's pets were roaming between houses and potentially carrying infections between houses. So that's another possibility. And some animals are instinctively probably just very good hunters, and others less so. And remember that the temperament of an animal can be bred into that animal. People have done experiments, so the famous Russian silver fox experiment, where they bred animals based on temperament by selecting for different characteristics and selectively mating the animals. And they were able to breed, they claim, animals which were extremely vicious versus animals that were extremely docile in relatively few generations. So therefore, there will be breeds which are probably bred to be a bit more lazy, and other breeds which you select for characteristics which happen to make them good hunters.
I'm in conversation with Dr. Chris Smith, also known as the Naked Scientist, answering all your science-related questions. A voice note now for you, Chris.
Good morning. A question for Dr. Chris. I'd like to find out. I'm 36 years old, and then we breathe dust every day from the time I was young up until my age. The amount of dust that could have been in my lungs could have filled my lungs up until they have no room for me to breathe air. How come we breathe dust, pollen, and all these other particles into our lungs, but they're never filled by this dust and other particles? What happens to the dust when we inhale the dust and into our lungs? What happens to that dust? KK, Kems Bay.
Hi, KK, and what a great question. And the answer is, you absolutely would fill your lungs very quickly with all the dust and muck and debris that we breathe in every day if there were not a mechanism to make sure that did not happen. And basically, there are stages at every step of the way into your lungs from the outside designed to help keep nasties out. In your mouth and in your nose, your airways are damp, and also in your nose, hairy, hopefully not the mouth. The hairs trap really big stuff, the dampness is sticky, and smaller stuff that happens to touch the walls sticks to the dampness, and you swallow it. As you go down into your airways, the airways restrict the flow of the air being drawn in, and it becomes turbulent. In other words, instead of being laminar, so it's in nice straight lines and flowing very evenly, it swirls around all over the place. And this is, although it's adding resistance to airflow, intentional, because what it does is have the effect of swirling the air and throwing it into the walls of your airways. And the walls of our airways are covered in a layer of sticky mucus and also tiny hairs called stereocilia. And if you look down a microscope, you can see these tiny hairs projecting from the cell surfaces, and they beat, they waft. And when they waft, they all waft together in the same direction, and this creates a current in the mucus. And that current is in the upwards direction. So as the beating happens and the current happens, any debris that's got stuck into the mucus, and this includes the dust we breathe in, viruses, bacteria, fungi, pollen, other things that we've encountered in the environments, pollution and so on, it's stuck in the mucus and it's all swept out continuously like a person with a broom all day, every day, up to the back of your throat, and then you swallow it and it goes down your guts and then it leaves the body via the normal route. So that is happening at all stages, right deep down into almost the deepest reaches of your lungs, and right at the bottom where you have the air sacs, that process finally gives way to just the air exchange system, where the air is by then so clean that really you can't really get anything more out of it. The only the tiniest particles make it down there, but that's not to say that some don't. And things like the emissions from diesel engines, tiny particles, that kind of thing, which are in the air, they can make it that far down into the lungs because our lungs have not evolved to deal with those sorts of pollutants because they wouldn't really have existed in nature until we came along with engines and industrial processes that would make them. They do make it down that far, and some of them then make it farther into the body. They go across the lung exchange surfaces and get into the bloodstream, believe it or not. But for the most part, the big stuff you can see is removed by those mechanisms I've explained, and that keeps your lungs clean mostly across a lifetime.
Chris, we've got a question from John in Malkbosstrand. Good morning, John. Go ahead.
Hi there. Good morning, Dr. Chris. I enjoy drinking dry rosé wine, and I put it in the deep freeze to freeze it, or to make it colder, but then accidentally I freeze it at times. Then when I defrost it, there's a sediment at the bottom of the bottle. The wine is perfectly drinkable. I find it drinkable. But I was wondering if that sediment, what it's actually made up of, and whether it's dangerous or not.
Oh, hi, John. I like rosé as well. I don't really like sweeter wines, but with rosé, I do actually quite like a sweeter one. And a friend of mine, Claire Bryant, at the University of Cambridge, she's actually a very famous immunologist, but an amazing wine buff. And she introduced me to sparkling rosé, which I'd not really gone near in the past. I don't know why. I just thought it might be a bit naff. I don't know why. How awful is that? And she introduced me to this beautiful sparkling rosé. And I'm totally, I wouldn't say addicted, but I'm hooked on having more of that now because it's just such a beautiful, refreshing flavour on a hot day. Lovely. But I do like it a little bit sweeter. But to answer your question, when you put anything with alcohol in it in the freezer, then what's going to happen is that the water will freeze because the ice cubes will pick up water molecules and you'll make a giant ice cube in the bottle. You have to be very careful because remember, of course, when ice forms, it takes up a lot more space than the equivalent amount of water it came from. And so the pressure in the bottle is going to go up, which can be sufficient to smash the bottle. So be very careful if you're accidentally freezing things like this. But when you remove water from the wine, you're leaving behind a higher concentration of alcohol for a start. And so therefore the alcohol concentration of what is left behind, if you don't completely freeze the beverage, is going to be a bit higher. And so you're doing a sort of ice distillation. I'm not sure that's legal, so be careful about that. But when you notice that sediment, most fine wines, as most wine drinkers and enjoyers will know, do contain some of the sediments from the grapes, unless they've been filtered to within an inch of their life. And actually, most wines which are made for the mass market, which where people are a bit turned off by sediment and think it's a sign of a lower quality, it's not at all. But some people then say, well, I like a really crystal clear wine. They do actually filter the wines off, or they settle them out and return to you only the really clear stuff. But good quality wines do have small amounts of sediment from the grapes, the proteins, the grape skins and so on that went into the winemaking process. And that tiny amount of sediment, when you freeze the wine, because that's not going to be in the ice cubes, it's going to settle, and the concentration is going to go up and up in the wine, and it's eventually going to sit at the bottom because it's going to be pushed out by the ice cubes that are forming in your wine. And it's then going to clump at the bottom. And then when you thaw the wine out, because you don't resuspend that stuff, it's just settled naturally at the bottom. It's left there for you to see when the ice melts and the drink reconstitutes back into its normal liquid. But the tiny amounts of sediment that were there imperceptibly floating around in the water are now clumped together and stuck together at the bottom.
A voice note, Chris?
Please, I want to know why and when did we tuck our tails under our skin so that it became a coccyx?
Oh, what a terrific question. I spoke to a guy earlier this year who did this sort of study genetically, and it was we called this the tale of the tail. And he said it was a really interesting study, this, because one of his researchers in his group in America got the idea to look at this question because he got into a taxi. In fact, he said he ordered an Uber, climbed into the back of this Uber, and sat down very hard on the seatbelt clip, the thing that you plug the seatbelt attachment into on the back seat, and it went right up his coccyx, and it was so painful. He thought, why the bloody hell have I got this thing that's here to be injured in this way? And so the research literally started as a pain in the ass. And they went and found animals with tails and animals that don't have tails, and they compared them genetically. And they found that there are regions of the DNA which have been changed in animals that don't have tails. And then you can ask the question, well, when did that happen? And the answer is that in the recent millions of years in our lineage, so we came from a sort of primate animal groups, and they evolved into a range of different animals you see around today that we're closely related to and us. And you go back a few million years and you find that this insertion has happened of this bit of DNA that's broken one of these genes which is concerned with how the body forms the spinal column. And that gene got changed a few million years ago. So there's your answer. It started this research as a pain in the arse, but became a very important research study. So you have to go back to about then to find out or to see back in history when we lost our tails.
Thank you, Chris. A question from Luke. What causes a ringworm on our skins?
Well, ringworm is a fungal infection. And we often see this, very common, and we often see this in kids who've been petting animals, people with animal contact, because this fungal infection comes from often an animal source. When we touch it, it transfers onto our skin. If it doesn't get brushed or washed away, and a breach in the skin allows it to get in, it gets into the surface layers of the skin, and then it forms a mycelium, a fungus infestation under the skin, which grows out in a ring shape. And it looks like a sort of worm because the skin is darkened and raised and red. And you'd think, oh, there's some kind of worm there, but it's not. It's a fungus.
Thank you, Chris. There's a follow-up question to your coccyx answer, Chris.
Good morning, Emmy. A question for the scientist. On the talk about the coccyx, what about some of us that still have that extra bone? Why do we still have people with the extra bone? I'm one of those people, Shireen.
Oh, hello, Shireen. I'm not aware that some people have lost any bones. We've got the same number of bones in our anatomy from top to bottom. Each of our vertebral bodies in our spine is a separate bone, and it goes right from the top of your neck down to the bottom of your coccyx. But in some people, the bones are slightly different shapes. Because we're all different shapes and sizes, some bones are bigger and more pronounced in some people than others, and also the amount of subcutaneous fat we carry varies across our life course and between individuals. So some people are bonier, or bones are more prominent or more visible in them than others. Therefore, I don't think you have additional bones. I'm not sure you have additional bones. If I'm wrong, please do tell me, somebody. But I'm pretty sure your anatomy is going to be the same, but maybe it's just more prominent in you than other people. But as I say, if there's something I'm missing here, please do let me know.
Thank you, Chris. A voice note from a listener.
Good morning, Professor. I'd love to know what the magic or the energy is that drives magnetic fields. It just doesn't seem to kind of, I can't make any sense of it. And I'd love to know if you have an answer for that. Thanks.
Good morning. Well, the answer is scientists don't know exactly why we have a magnetic field. But what we can say is that it's something to do with the quantum behavior of the atoms in substances that are susceptible to being magnetized. And in the case of iron, the simplest way to think about this, if you think about an iron magnet, is that there are atoms of iron in the metal, lined up all the way through the metal, and they have a property of their electrons which is called the spin, quantum spin. Now, it's not physically spin, but it's convenient to think of it as something spinning in one direction. All the atoms in an unmagnetized piece of iron have these quantum spin at random, pointing in random directions. We refer to them as dipoles. And if you've got a random assortment of them all pointing in random directions, they're all cancelling each other out, so there's no net magnetic field. But for various reasons, in magnetically susceptible materials like iron, you can induce all of those dipoles to line up. So all the quantum spin properties align along a magnetic field. And when they do that, they contribute a net magnetic field. So if you take a piece of molten metal, subject it to a magnetic field and cool it down, the arrangement of those dipoles, which are originally all floating around a mobile, because they all line up with the magnetic field, then fix when you make the metal go solid. You can also do this by streaking or stroking a magnet, permanent magnet, along your piece of iron, and it will slowly pull all of those dipoles into alignment. And when you have that arrangement, then you create a magnetic field. And a field is merely where you have a difference in one magnetic potential in one place and a different magnetic potential going away from it. And you create a field between those two extremes where anything placed within that field is subject to or feels the magnetic field. But if you ask a scientist to explain, well, why does that particular quantum property give you this phenomenon of magnetism and how does it work? Well, that's where it's difficult to explain, and I don't think we can.
Thank you so much. That was Dr. Chris Smith, also known as the Naked Scientist, answering all your science-related questions and always so insightful. Thank you very much, Chris, and have a wonderful weekend.
And you have a great weekend, everybody. See you next time.